The United Nations this week threatened North Korea with new sanctions following the country's latest missile launch. If confirmed, the results of North Korea's latest test suggest it could hit targets as far away as Guam, where the U.S. has a military base. That has further raised tension between North Korea, South Korea, and the United States. But to understand the situation on the Korean Peninsula, it helps to understand the Korean War. So to do that, let's bring in Catherine Weathersby, a visiting professor of history at Korea University. She joins us from Seoul by Skype. And Professor, take us back to the split at the end of World War II when we got two Koreas.
It happened rather accidentally. At the end of the war against Japan, the Soviets occupied the north and the Americans occupied the south. They were supposed to agree on creating a provisional government that would create a new government for Korea, but they had opposite goals. And so in 1948, two separate governments got created. But the key thing is both of them believed that they were the government of all of Korea. And that is still essentially the situation. So there are rival governments. It's not just that there are two governments. They are rival governments.
The war itself was very brutal. I read that the U.S. dropped more explosives on North Korea in that war than it did in the entire Pacific theater of World War II.
Yes, it did. And I think the bombing is really important because it was so unbelievably destructive. I saw a Soviet report by an official who was sent to North Korea at the end of the war to assess the damage because the Soviet government knew it would have to rebuild. And the estimate was that 85% of all buildings in the entire country were destroyed. Now, in the entire country.
Yeah.
it's a level of destruction that no other country has experienced.
Why was it like that? Why was this war so vicious?
Well, it became a stalemate by the spring of 1951, after beginning the summer of 1950. Once the U.S. and other U.N. countries entered on behalf of the South, and then the Chinese entered on behalf of the North, they reached a point where neither side could advance. It's important that Korea is a mountainous country because that means that both sides could dig into the mountains to put their artillery pieces in fortified concrete bunkers. And when that happens, and when there are enough of them, and there are thousands of them, neither side can advance because they would be, you know, overwhelmed by artillery fire from the other side. And with that being the situation on the ground and the armistice negotiations dragging on just endlessly, the U.S., out of frustration, did the only thing that it could do, which was to bomb. It just bombed and bombed and bombed. And then, you know, it ran out of targets and it just kept bombing again, bombed the same targets over and over and over. It's not difficult to imagine the kind of fear that created.
And the war went on for 3 years, but the war never really officially ended, did it?
No, it only concluded with an armistice in July of 53, which normally just is a temporary ceasefire to create the conditions for negotiating a peace treaty. But a peace treaty was never negotiated. All we have is the presumably temporary ceasefire that's been in place now since 1953. It's quite extraordinary.
Why is the war referred to in the U.S. sometimes as the Forgotten War?
Oh, I think because it was basically a tie. The dividing line is close to where North and South Korea were divided in the first place. But because it wasn't a great victory like World War II, there wasn't much to celebrate. And then after Vietnam, the attention was taken by Vietnam. So, yeah, but certainly the war is not forgotten here.
Yeah.
It's very much alive here on the peninsula. And it's not forgotten in China either.
Well, and how did it get us to where we are today? How much does the Korean War from the 1950s have to do with the situation on the Korean Peninsula right now?
Well, I think there's several important legacies. One is the bombing that I mentioned a minute ago, the fear. But beyond that, the war also produced quite considerable distrust of North Korea's allies. North Korea's relationship with China is very fraught. At the same time, it knows that because China doesn't want chaos on its border with Korea, and Russia doesn't want chaos on its border, both of them are going to keep supporting North Korea. And so North Korea has been in this position of being able to do quite outrageous things, knowing that its patrons are not going to desert it. I would say one other thing, too, that's important to keep in mind. South Korea, as we know, has become fantastically successful economically. So the specter of being absorbed by the South in the way that East Germany was absorbed by West Germany is quite frightening. The North is extremely vulnerable. You know, in 1989, it lost its allies in Eastern Europe when all of the Soviet bloc countries got rid of their communist governments. All of them had been supporters of North Korea. Mm. And then before the Soviet Union fell apart, it decided to make relations with South Korea because it was so desperate for economic aid, which is really ironic. I mean, the Soviets turned to Seoul to bail them out.
Well, and all along, by the way, the Kim family has been in charge in North Korea, right since the war.
Yes, exactly. Well, since before the war, since the Soviets moved in to North Korea in 1945. Yeah, they chose Kim Il-sung to be the leader, and then his son and now his grandson are still there. So it's a dynasty.
Was that the way that the government worked in Korea before, or is that a new phenomenon for the country?
No, Korea was certainly a dynasty before the period of Japanese rule that began in 1910. So in that sense, it's quite normal. But when South Korea was established in 1948, there was no consideration of reviving the monarchy. So for people in the South, the fact that the North Koreans have basically a dynasty seems rather ridiculous.
Hmm. So it sounds like what you're saying is it's unlikely, given how different these places are at this point, that there's going to be some grand reunification anytime soon. What about another war? Is that more likely?
Well, the North's development of nuclear weapons and its quite energetic missile program is adding a new wrinkle to this situation. At the same time, on another level, the society in the North is changing quite dramatically. New moneyed classes of people are being created who are much more independent of the state than North Korean citizens ever have been. Money now talks rather than membership in the party. You know, once money is the issue rather than ideology, it's much easier to deal with people. It's much easier to come up with solutions. Hmm. And the North are not ideological zealots like ISIS or Taliban. In fact, they really don't have any ideology at all, I would say, by this time, other than trying to keep the system going. One other important thing is that if they were absorbed by the South, they would be at the very bottom of the social structure, and they know that. Those at the top would likely be put in jail. They have a more immediate reason to keep their system going. But even those at the kind of middle level of the society would basically lose everything. You know, I mean, is Samsung going to hire a factory manager from North Korea? Well, you know. Not likely.
Well, but what it sounds like you're saying is that after all these years, even if South Korea is obviously the much more successful of the two, that North Korea is holding a lot of cards in the situation and keeping the system the way that it is now.
Yeah, we call this the leverage of the weak. Hmm. They're quite skillful, at using the leverage of the weak.
That's Catherine Weathersby, who's a professor at Korea University in Seoul, South Korea. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.